Mouth Radio Show. I'm Paula Slater, your host. This is an interview-based podcast where I have conversations with some of the most creative and interesting people in the horse world. Today I'd like to welcome Pauline Kiley from A Passionate Pen. Welcome, Pauline.
Thank you, Paula.
Now, you've written a book called No Poverty Between the Sheets. It's a memoir, and your writing has horses that have been woven through the book. Is that right?
Absolutely. Horses have played a huge part in my life and throughout my family. My both grandfathers had horses. My father and I were avid horse lovers. And horses have everything to do with the ending of this story.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start riding?
Riding horses when I was 10 years old.
Oh, I'm sorry. When did you start writing?
Oh, writing. I began writing when I was 14 years old. I saw a film in health class about seniors being lonely. And I began writing my Irish granny letters every week, every other week. And from there, I was an avid reader and always had aspirations of becoming a writer someday. I have taken courses at any time that there was something, you know how it just comes? There would be a creative writing group in the community. So I joined that. And then I took courses at U of T and courses at Trent and joined the writers community of Durham Region. I can't remember a time when I wasn't writing.
The horses in the story of No Poverty Between the Sheets, which is based on my great giant family, was a white Connemara pony called Bubbles that my great-granddad had. And my father and my granddad used to go into Dublin to collect broken biscuits and old bread for the pigs and the chickens. And my father remembers clip-clopping through Dublin, and the old fella fell asleep, and they went through a stop sign. So my dad elbows his grandfather and he says, "Granddad, we're after going through this stop sign." And the old fella says, "Don't worry yourself, Bubbles knows her way home." So it was, you know, he used to tell us these stories about Ireland sitting around the kitchen table, and there became this little fascination with horses. Dad being a builder, we ended up out on a 1-acre property, and I went for a walk thinking, "Where have you moved me to? I live in the middle of a field." And I came upon 3 Palomino horses out grazing, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I thought they were the most beautiful thing. So while they were building the house, I would go over and sit in the grass and just watch these horses and, you know, pull grass and feed these horses. I just thought they were just the cat's pajamas. You just, you know, for a 10-year-old girl, that's when I got bitten bad by the horse bug. And from there, I met I called him expert horseman, Brian Colden, this kind of wild young kid that used to fly around on a Palomino and a paint. He had a paint horse called Comanche, and he had a bay mare called Mandy, and I would ride Mandy sometimes. Mandy was the gentlest soul. 6 kids could, you know, sit on her back, and she'd just take us all afternoon. Just kind old girl. And I had a really special childhood. I lived near the Vivian Forest, and there was probably 10 or 12 of my friends that had horses, and we spent sunrise to sunset out flying around the trails and just living the dream. You know, it was a little bit like Tom Sawyer in the 70s. So yeah, really good life.
Mm-hmm. And did you write anything from that time period as a young person?
Absolutely.
About your horse adventures?
Yeah, that chapter is, I've got a couple of chapters in there about I don't want to give away too much, but I'll tell you the funniest part. This'll crack you up. When I was 10 years old, I got my dad's sawhorses, and I was sitting on the sawhorses, and I stacked a bit of lumber, and that was my stall. And he came home from work one day, and I'm in the garage, and I'm talking away to my sawhorse, and he comes around the corner, and he says, "Who are you talking to?" And I said, "My horse. This is my horse. There's her stall. You know, this is my little barn." And he's just like, "Okay. Come on inside. Your mother's got your dinner ready." And as he's walking into the house, I can see him scratching his head, you know. So after dinner, he pushes back from the table and he says to my mom, "I'm taking Pauline out on Saturday. We need to go horse shopping. I won't have any young one of mine talking to herself out in the garage." So my mother walks over to the closet and opens the double doors and starts talking. And he says, "Well, who are you talking to?" She says, "My fur coat."
Yeah.
So
good.
That's kind of comedy that's in my household, you know. And yeah, that's why I wrote the book, is because I had this Irish father right off the boat and this little French Canadian mother from Northern Ontario. And once a month, the house would fill up with Irish people going, "Pauline, how are you now, love?" And then 2 weeks later, it was, "Pauline, pourquoi? Comment ça va?" You know, and I'm just like, "God, what were you thinking?" They're like two sticks of dynamite. And I never, you know, the comedy was just nonstop. So when I was in Ireland later in life with my sister and my father, and we actually were lucky enough to go to the Dublin Horse Show, and I wrote about that. We came home from the Dublin Horse Show, and my granny had the telly on, and she's watching the highlights. So my sister spotted a chestnut like my father's, and she says, "Oh, Granny, there's a horse like Daz back home." And she said, "Your father on a horse, you must be joking. Sure, it's an elephant he should be riding. A man that size could give the horse a carry." And so, it was just nonstop. And if somebody didn't capture it, it would have been a sin, because they were just so funny, you know. And even my Irish granny, she was talking about the tragedies of her childhood and the TB that went through her family and the poverty, you know. And I said to her, "Geez, if you were so poor, why did you have 10 kids? And she says, "Ah, to be certain, there was no poverty between the sheets." And so my title was born, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, was this your first book?
I wrote a children's book called Santa and the Whippersnapper, mm-hmm. and that's actually a story of my daughter getting her pony when she was about 5 for Christmas one year. Mm-hmm. And then this book, actually, I took a number of courses and I wrote chapters in fiction, chapters in third person. But finally, I took a memoir course. I found my true voice, and the book just poured. It just flowed right out of me, which really worked out. My sequel title will be out very shortly. I've just given it to the editor last Thursday, and I'm just delighted with it. And from there, I can see the third book brewing. It's been quite a journey, really quite a journey.
Mm-hmm.
The first book is basically setting up the foundation of the family and, you know, where I'm coming from. And then the second book is titled Divorce is Dirty and Hell is Hot. And it takes readers on a journey through, you know, a harsh divorce and, you know, a little bit of a journey into finding who you are and what you're about and what you stand for, and raising teenagers on your own, being a woman who up until then had, you know, basically I just wanted to have a nice family. I came from a nice family and I thought everyone out there was pretty much a nice person. Unfortunately, I had to learn a hard lesson that no, they're not all nice people. And sometimes, you know, it is all part of the journey. And now looking back on it or reflecting on it or seeing it from another angle, I can really see exactly why it all happened and how it had to. Horses, again, play a huge part in my life and healing. It's funny. I'll think I'm finished with horses, you know, and then they come back to me. And I'm just thrilled with the way the second book has come together. So just mm-hmm. thrilled.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the writing process, how do you handle that yourself? Do you keep a little notebook with you, or do you come home and write, or how does that work for you?
This is where every writer is different, and some people do have notepads with them all the time. I have a hard drive, and it's in my head, and once I just basically lock myself in a room, it's like I'm a binge writer.
Okay.
So basically for the last 2-3 weeks, it's very common for me to do a 17-hour day, do not disturb, just stay out of my way. I'm writing. And like that, that's how I write. I understand Stephen King, you know, makes a point to write 1,500 words a day. That's not how I roll. I'm a binge writer, so I write in spurts. It's funny how sometimes my temper will spur me on where something will not sit right and I'll have to go in and think about it and process it. And the keys, that's when the smoke's just flying off the computer keys, you know.
No, well, that's really interesting because, again, in the creative process, it's sort of like a circle that people sort of gather information and then they produce and then gather information and then produce. And it's sort of a circular pattern, as I see it in the visual arts anyways, that you have time for processing and then producing. Now, like you say, everybody's different, but... I always think it's interesting to share that, especially for younger people who are writing, how they can be directed or guided in that way.
My son writes music, and essentially he seems to be the same, where, say, I'm painting a room or I'm doing something physical, cutting the lawn. My mind will be thinking about things and processing, you know, if I know that, okay, I'm on a deadline. It's going to just be working it through. And then when I sit down, I do a short meditation, which really brings me into where I was, maybe what kind of music was playing, what the weather might have been like, you know, if I had a favorite pair of shoes or something that really stood out at that time. And that might be my starting point. And from there, it just flows. So it is actually quite phenomenal to try and understand all the different ways that people work. But as I mentioned to you earlier, I do believe it takes all kinds of flowers to make a garden. And this is the way I work, and this works the best for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you thinking about continuing with the? Well, as you said, you found your voice with memoirs. So, do you think you'll continue on this way, or?
Actually, I think before I put out the third in this trilogy, I'm going to take a break because I have been having so many phenomenal horse people coming into my life, and they're not getting any younger. So I'd really like to take the time to capture some of their stories. Most recently, we host the Dave Duvall Charity Golf Tournament to raise funds for the Salvation Army, and we invited Sandy Hawley, the jockey Sandy Hawley, and I had a chance to have a chat with him. And he's got some stories that are kind of behind the scenes, and what a personable man. So I'd like to write some of his stories. And then I also have a fella that is named Hugh Morstead, and he builds jumps. But he was a jockey back in the day, and he came from Ireland, and he talked a lot about his childhood and waiting behind jumps for the people to fall off. And he would actually steal their mount and finish the hunt. And if by the time they got, and he was so picky, he would wait for the better thoroughbreds. He would watch, you know, here's this kid, 11, 12, 13 years old, and he's watching the hunt field, and he's picking the horse that he'd like to get to. And he said he would park himself behind a bank or a, you know, a jump, and he knew that this is going to be a tough jump and somebody's going to come off here. And the person that came off would be thinking, oh, you're a great chap, you know, going to catch his horse, only to see him jump up and take off on his horse. He had me in stitches yesterday with some of the stories he was telling. So, and then I had the good fortune of meeting a gentleman who was headhunted by E.P. Taylor to come here from England with his family. And he worked at Winfield Farms, and he has a copy of Northern Dancer's birth certificate or his papers. And he was somebody who was a caretaker too, you know, one of Canada's greatest treasures, right? And so he was kind of the gentleman that the horse came home to. He was his grandpa, if you'd like to say, you know. He was his grounding person, and he had some really nice insight too. So I think I'm going to take a break from this and have a bit of fun interviewing some people with great horse stories.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. And it's interesting that we're talking about E.P. Taylor and Winfield Farms again, because I just finished an interview with the stallion manager, Peter Hurst, who came over from England in the 70s and worked at the Winfield Farms. So it's all connecting.
Is he a British fella?
Yes.
It could be, that might be my neighbor. As I said, I'm not remembering his name. Be my neighbor.
No, he lives in Vancouver on the island. On the island.
That's funny.
But I think what's really interesting here is how horses are fostering all sorts of things. Creativity, you know, connections. It's wonderful. Exciting.
I really didn't see myself having horses again. And I had horses up until from 10 till I was 35. And then there was the breakup of the marriage and, you know, my three teenage children on my own. And then my daughter married and I had grandchildren and I was living in town and working for the newspaper. And I just didn't see myself having horses again. And then I met a gentleman who grew up in Toronto. He was a basketball player and, you know, loved animals, but had never been around horses. One day he had a meeting in Toronto and I said, oh, the Royal's on. And he says, what's that? I said, oh, biggest horse show there is. Well, let's go. I said, I haven't gone in years. So while we were there, because, you know, he's asking me what's going on with the dressage or what's going on with stadium jumping, what's happening now, what kind of breed is that? And he's like, you know all about this stuff. And I said, well, yeah, you know, I've been around once or twice. And from there, he ended up finding this little farm and we moved in last August. We got two 20-year-old draft crosses that are retired from South Algonquin Trail Rides in Halliburton. So they're just two bomb-proof, kind gentlemen that are just lovely, lovely. One's a leopard Appaloosa and the other's a big old bay, and they're so kind. Anyway, we ended up at the auction trying to buy some buckets and a few tidbits for the winter, you know. And this young filly came into the ring and she kept stopping in front of Michael. And, you know, I'm going, no, we don't need a third horse. We're two old people with two old horses and that's just fine. And he said, but she's talking to me. She wants me. Well, nobody bid on this horse. The bidding only went up to $400. And so the owner said, I can't sell this horse for that. I paid $15,000 for her mother. And so we spoke to the lady at the end of the auction, and she's a veterinarian. She breeds Tricaner. This young horse had an accident with an electric fence, so she had some tendon damage. She can't do dressage, or you're not going to ask her to jump, but otherwise she is completely sound. And I just looked at this horse and said, wow, there's my foundation broodmare, or a horse that I'd love to breed. And she's our little sweetheart. So it's amazing. I can't believe it that I actually even considered not having horses in my life, because what they give and the healing that they do for our hearts is just humbling.
Mm-hmm. And I hear that so much, you know, so much. And it's encouraging that we're learning this in this day and age, that this is a job for horses that may find a terrible end, but they can be employed as a partner in helping to heal people, especially with post-traumatic stress disorders, and just wonderful stories of what they are doing in this world compared to what was happening in the past. So this is a new, I think, direction for people. And it's always interesting.
There seems to be a shift.
Yes.
Where people are disengaging because of technology and the speed of which things are coming at us, where the horses are helping us re-engage with our emotions, mm-hmm. and nature. But the other thing of it is, yoga is very popular, and I've taken some guided meditation and some yoga and learned about my chakras. Well, I realized when I'm on the horse, my chakras are directly connecting with the horse's chakras. Like, we're all one energy. Like, it's incredible. It's incredible. And it's not even something that you have to scientifically diagnose. It's an experience. Mm-hmm. You know, for somebody who actually thought that horses couldn't be part of my life, I'm so humbled by the fact that, no, they are my I call them now my spirit animal, and I need to have them in my life.
Yes, I would agree with that term, spirit animal. Yes. And it's true that horses will choose you like they chose Michael.
This little girl is hilarious. She's such a smiley and a ham bone. And here she is. She's young. She's just four. So she's got lots of energy. And these two old fellas are like Humpty and Dumpty, you know. Yeah. They're like going, seriously, you want to run?
Yeah. That's great.
Well, yeah.
Pauline, let's go back to your writing. And I wanted to ask you about the latest award that you've been given, the Book Buzz Prize Writer or Memoir for Memoirs, and you just received that award?
I did. That award came through April the 4th is International Book Day, or mm-hmm. So the prize was announced, or the award was announced, on the International Book Day. It was basically an internet site that is promoting books, and they put up this competition. So you submitted, and if they had top 10 in every category, so horror, you know, everything from fiction, mystery, crime, everything was, so they had all the different categories. Memoir, they had such a high response that they actually had 13 books listed to vote for in the memoir category. And what ended up happening is three of us broke away from the pack. People voted for the books. They went to the site and they voted for the book that they liked. So three of us really kind of broke away from the crowd. We were campaigning and we really gained some ground on the other people. And towards the end, I was so humbled. The two other people that were sort of neck and neck with me both took the time to read my book. And their comments were, I've got some people that I've held back for voting and your book deserves to win. And I'm going to tell them to vote for you because they were so touched by my story and my style. I shoot straight from the hip, straight aiming right for the heart. No shenanigans. The book is just raw, honest, and rock and roll. I'm not anybody who's a celebrity or you know, anybody that's any different than anybody else. I've had a colorful and, I'll say, sometimes challenging life. And I just feel that I really want to share it so that other people can either identify or maybe learn a little something of, well, I don't need to do that because she already did. Unbelievable. I've sold, you know, thousands of books, but the feedback has been so humbling. I had an 80-year-old lady come out to a reading I was doing at the library at 8 o'clock at night. It's cold, it's dark, and she had a walker and she came down the stairs to the room I was in and she said, I got your book for Christmas. I've read it 3 times. And anytime I want to laugh, I open it up anywhere. She said, I just had to meet you. And I'm not kidding you. Wow. And then I had another lady knock on my door one day and say, I read your book. I had to meet you and I need a hug. I was like, wow. So this is the kind of thing that's happening. I'm going to book clubs and I walk in the room and people feel like they know me after they've read my book and mm-hmm. they're comfortable with, and I'm fine. I'm, you know, I, as I said, I come from a big family, so I'm used to giving people a hug or whatever. I am very open and honest. So it's just amazing. You know, they have no problem telling me, you know, who they like in the book and who they don't like in the book and the horses, you know, it's amazing how people love the whole horse angle of things. So
yes. Now, Pauline, you're going, you're doing a special tour this August, a virtual book tour. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm working with a company called I Read Book Tours. They're actually out of Montreal and my tour dates are August 10th to 28th. It's a virtual book tour and it starts with basically I've got bloggers from all over the world that are going to blog about my book. And then I also have some interviews that'll be a follow up to that. There's the tour stops include like Library of Clean Reads, Life as Lels, I'd Rather Be at the Beach, all these Book and Ink, Just One More Chapter. It's all these different bloggers that have huge followings. So apparently it will help get... I, as a self-published author, have been working at getting the book into the mainstream for more book clubs. And I've done a lot on my own. Why I choose to be self-published, I actually have had meetings and had, you know, dealings with the big houses. And once I sell the rights to, say, Penguin or House of Anansi or one of these big publishers, they campaign the book if it doesn't go, the book dies. Well, I don't want to see that happen. So I've held on to my rights, which a lot of writers are doing now, because there's been such a shift in the publishing industry mm-hmm. in the last 10 years that it is actually in a writer's best interest. Yeah, so this is just a marketing platform that came into play. I went to the Inspire Book Fair in Toronto and I met Laura, who developed this company, and she's had some great success, and we're working together. And the idea was to do this book tour right before the sequel book comes out, so that if, you know, the readers enjoy this one, then that gives a little bit of a leg up to the one that's coming out.
Some momentum. Now, how can listeners find out or follow this book tour? Will this be on your website?
Absolutely. It'll be a link to it on my website, on my Facebook and Twitter and all of the other, you know, everything else I'm involved in. So,
okay. So can you just give us contact information, your URL for your website and your Facebook, and the rest, of course, will be on the Straight from the Horse's Mouth radio show page, but could you do this now?
Sure. My website is www.paulinekiley.ca, and it's Pauline with Kiley is K-I-E-L-Y. And then my Facebook is the same. It's just Pauline Kiley. Oh, and then I am on LinkedIn and, as I said, Twitter. And I could provide those links for you to add to your Straight from the Horse's Mouth. I actually wrote a column in the Uxbridge Times Journal for a couple of years called Straight from the Horse's Mouth. So congratulations, Paula. That, you know, we're kindred spirits that way, because obviously you're a lady that likes to shoot straight as well, but also inform, right?
Right.
Educate and inform and share.
Share.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, listen, Pauline, this has been just great. And I wish you all the best for the next book that you're going to publish. And I just want to thank you again for a great interview. And we'll say goodbye then.
Well, thank you very, very much. Have a great day, and goodbye for now.
Okay, then. I hope you enjoyed my interview today with Pauline Kiley, author of No Poverty Between the Sheets and Divorce is Dirty and Hell is Hot. For more information and links about Pauline, go to straightfromthehorsesmouthradioshow.com. Today's podcast has been brought to you by Natural Alternative Grazers. That's NAGBAGS for short. For more information, use horsesmouthhaynet.com. NAGBAGS make a variety of nets, round bale hay nets in different sizes, square bale nets, and also nets that will be suitable for the trailer and the stall. We've been using NAGBAGS now for more than 4 years on our farm and find them to be a quality product. For more information, go to horsesmouthhaynet.com. That's horsesmouthanet.com. This is Paula Slater, signing off.